way to do that is by pointing out the four trials that Paul faces in these chapters. They are trials in the sense of difficulties and troubles that he faces, but they are actually legal court trials. Here's the first one. So in chapter 23, the beginning of chapter 23, Paul faces a trial with the Sanhedrin, that's the Jewish court in Jerusalem. The high priest, Ananias, is presiding. The Roman commander who arrested Paul is also there at that trial. The result of the trial is that the Pharisees and Sadducees fight over a theological issue that has very practical aspects to it, over the resurrection. The Pharisees believed in the resurrection, the Sadducees didn't. The outcome is that the Pharisees declare Paul innocent, but a riot breaks out. So after that trial, which we get in the end of chapter 23, God tells Paul in a vision that he's going to go to Rome. 40 Jews vow and plot to kill him. And as a result, the commander sends him to Governor Felix in Caesarea. And this is where he faces his next trial, trial number two, in chapter 24. So the governor, Felix, presides over this one, and it's in Caesarea. Ananias's lawyer is the one who brings the charges on behalf of the Jews. Now, interestingly, the Asian Jews who were causing trouble for Paul weren't actually at this trial, so there was a bit of a mistrial going on, which was pointed out during the proceedings. The result of this trial is that Felix puts off making a decision, and he adjourns the trial and places Paul under arrest for 2 years. After the trial, Felix, along with his wife Drusilla, meet with Paul regularly over that period of 2 years, until Felix is finally replaced by the next procurator, by the next governor, by Festus. And that brings us to the third trial, which is in chapter 25. Governor Festus is presiding over this trial, and it's in Caesarea again. The chief priests and the Jews are present, bringing charges. The result of this trial is that Festus offers Paul a trial back in Jerusalem. But Paul wants to go to Rome. He wants his trial to be in Rome, and so he appeals as a Roman citizen to Caesar. And then in the last part of chapter 25, third chapter we're looking at today, King Agrippa and wife Bernice meet with Festus. King Agrippa's just come to a position of leadership. He meets with Festus, and Festus tells him all about Paul. And as a result, King Agrippa gets involved, and trial number four begins, before Agrippa, with Festus present. And I'm going to leave Will next week to cover just one chapter. That's not fair, is it? I should have given him one of mine. But he's covering just one chapter next week, the very important trial before King Agrippa, and I'll let him tell you all about the outcome of that. So that's a very quick overview of those three chapters. Perhaps a little bit hard to see. I hope that helps you make some sense of it. We're now going to have our Bible reading, and it's from Acts 25, verses 1 to 12. And it's about the third trial.
I'm reading from the NIV version. So Acts 25, 1 to 12. Paul's trial before Festus. 3 days after arriving in the province, Festus went up from Caesarea to Jerusalem, where the chief priests and the Jewish leaders appeared before him and presented the charges against Paul. They requested Festus, as a favour to them, to have Paul transferred to Jerusalem, for they were preparing an ambush to kill him along the way. Festus answered, "Paul is being held at Caesarea, and I myself am going there soon. Let some of your leaders come with me, and if the man has done anything wrong, they can press charges against him there." After spending 8 or 10 days with them, Festus went down to Caesarea. The next day, he convened the court and ordered that Paul be brought before him. When Paul came in, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him. They brought many serious charges against him, but they could not prove them. Then Paul made his defence. "I have done nothing wrong against the Jewish law, or against the temple, or against Caesar." Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favour, said to Paul, "Are you willing to go up to Jerusalem and stand trial before me on these charges?" Paul answered, "I am now standing before Caesar's court, where I ought to be tried. I have not done any wrong to the Jews, as you yourself very well know. If, however, I am guilty of doing anything deserving death, I do not refuse to die. But if the charges brought against me by these Jews are not true, no one has the right to hand me over to them. I appeal to Caesar." After Festus had conferred with his council, he declared, "You have appealed to Caesar. To Caesar you will go."
My sermon this morning is not really a sermon, at least not what a normal sermon is like, or not normally what I do when I preach. In the time available, I simply want to share with you a couple of my personal reactions to this passage and to the rest of those three chapters. And the first thing that stands out for me here in this passage is Paul's commitment, his utter commitment to sharing the gospel. We've seen this before as he travelled through Galatia and Asia and Macedonia and Achaia and Cyprus and other places as well on his missionary journeys. We've seen him tirelessly sharing the gospel. He was seemingly unstoppable, and that was a big factor in the unstoppable spread of the gospel out from Jerusalem. But it's one thing to do that as a free man, but in these chapters he's under arrest, but he doesn't let up. During his court trials, he defends himself, but he also witnesses to Jesus whenever he can. In that first paragraph there, that's from Acts 24, the second trial before Felix, he says this, "However, I admit that I worship the God of our ancestors as a follower of the way, which they call a sect. I believe everything that is in accordance with the law and that is written in the prophets, and I have the same hope in God as these men themselves have, that there will be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked." After the trial, as I mentioned before, we find him witnessing to Felix, the governor who was in charge of the trial, and also to his wife Drusilla, something that happens multiple times over that two-year period. We see that in Acts 24 after the second trial. And here he is privately, not just speaking publicly, but now privately with Felix and Drusilla. A few days later, Felix came back with his wife, Drusilla, who was Jewish, his wife Drusilla, who was Jewish, sending for Paul. They listened as he told them about faith in Christ Jesus, as he reasoned with them about righteousness and self-control and the coming day of judgment. Felix became frightened. "Go away for now," he replied. "When it is more convenient, I'll call for you again." He talks to both Felix and Priscilla about faith in Jesus Christ, we're told there. No doubt in that included telling them about the death and the resurrection of Jesus, the Messiah, the chosen one from God, especially seeing that Drusilla was Jewish. But he also challenged them, and I find this interesting, especially Felix, about the implications of the gospel for right living. He talked to them about righteousness or justice in some versions, about self-control and the coming day of judgment. According to the historian Josephus, Felix had lustfully enticed Drusilla to leave her husband and to marry him as his third wife. And Felix was renowned for his cruelty and was actually recalled to Rome. Effectively, he was sacked, and that's why Festus came in and replaced him. He was sacked because of his heavy-handed response to some of the strife, particularly the Jewish and Gentile strife that was happening in Caesarea. Now, I found myself comparing my commitment to Paul's as I reflected devotionally on this passage. And I must confess that I don't think it compares very favourably. I'm okay with sharing the gospel publicly in some situations, such as a sermon, or when people are already followers of Jesus, but not so much in small groups or one-on-one with people that aren't Christians, which is really the whole point of sharing the gospel, I guess, isn't it? So that's an issue. Part of my issue, I think, is being too focused on knockbacks in the past and possible knockbacks currently, rather than focusing on those times when someone has responded positively to the gospel and have accepted Jesus, and reflecting on how their life has been joyously transformed as a result. So that's one challenge that I find from this passage, to be more committed to seizing the God-given opportunities to share the gospel of Jesus. Second thing that I'm struck by is Paul's courage in sharing the gospel. After his first trial, the one that was aborted, the Sanhedrin trial, 40 Jews took a vow to neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. Sometimes wonder what actually happened to them, but we're not told. Because their plot failed when the young nephew of Paul heard about it and alerted the Roman commander. But Paul's life had been under serious threat. And an indication of that, I think, is the number of soldiers that were assigned to escort him to Caesarea. There were two centurions, and the reason for that is because there were 200 soldiers, plus 70 horsemen, plus 200 spearmen. Now, this wasn't for fear of Paul escaping. It was for fear of him being killed by these 40 and perhaps others who they might have been able to round up as well. Paul faced two main charges during these trials that we're looking at. He faced the charge of sacrilege against the temple and the Jewish law. Paul denies this, declaring himself to be a loyal son of Israel. But the other charge was sedition against Caesar and the Roman state. But again, Paul denies this, saying he's a loyal citizen of Rome. But the point is that these were both capital offences. In other words, if convicted, he faced the death penalty. But regardless of that, Paul witnesses, despite the opposition, despite the danger. I mentioned his private sessions with Felix and Drusilla over 2 years and his challenges, his very pointed challenges to them. That's another example, I think, of Paul's courage. He would have been very aware that Felix held the same power over him as Pontius Pilate had held over Jesus. Notice when notice what he says in trial 3 before Festus, there on the top of the slide. "If then I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything for which I deserve to die, I do not seek to escape death. But if there is anything, if there is nothing to their charges against me, no one can give me up to them. I appeal to Caesar." It's very clear that Paul was willing to die for Jesus and for the sake of the gospel. He courageously opted for a trial at the heart of the Roman Empire, no doubt mindful of God's words to him after his trial by the Sanhedrin, there in Acts 23:11. The following night, the Lord stood near Paul and said, "Take courage, as you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome." In Acts, of course, Luke's main focus is on Paul. But there were many others around the time of Paul who faced persecution and were prepared to die and did die for their faith. And unfortunately, that has continued down through the centuries and still the reality today. I say unfortunately that they were killed, but fortunately they held firm and remained committed to Jesus and showed great courage. Each year, the organisation Open Doors publishes a report called the World Watch List, which is on persecution of Christians throughout the world. Here are some of the headline numbers. They are statistics, but of course we are talking about people. 1 in 7 Christians in... Can't quite read that. 1 in 7 Christians worldwide are persecuted. 1 in 5 Christians in Asia, in Africa, sorry, and 2 in 5 in Asia. I'm glad you can read. have better eyesight than I have. Put that all together, more than 360 million Christians last year were suffering high levels of persecution and discrimination for their faith. 5,621 Christians were murdered. Over 2,000 churches attacked. 4,500 Christians detained. And on the side of the slide there, you have the list, the list of the top 11 countries where persecution is the greatest. Here is a map of where persecution is the worst. Do you notice anything? There's not many places free of persecution, are there? But Australia is one of them. And my first thought when I saw that map was, we are so blessed to live in Australia, and we are. But I think I should have been thinking, all those poor people elsewhere. All those courageous people who persist in their faith despite such severe opposition and persecution. 3 days ago, I received an email that the association sends out to pastors at the beginning of each month, and it usually contains all sorts of things such as news and coming events and resources. This time it included a little snippet about one of the staff, Marbuen Diaz, who recently attended a multicultural pastor's retreat in Victoria. And he listened as a pastor from a Myanmar diaspora church, apologised for appearing tired at the morning session. And the reason for his tiredness? Well, he shared with them that it was for staying up multiple nights in a row, hearing, grieving and praying, as he heard of houses and church buildings being burnt down close to the borders of Myanmar where he used to live, where his home was. Myanmar isn't even in the top 11 countries for persecution, though it probably will be when Open Doors does its report next year. But at that time, which is a few weeks ago now, around 120 church buildings, Christian church buildings, had been burnt down. And these church buildings weren't just places where people gathered for worship on Sunday. These were places of refuge where many had fled hoping to be safe after having their homes destroyed because they were Christians. The pastor said he'd run out of tears and did not know what to do anymore. But he said, "I'm still clinging to the hope of Jesus and his way, as are my people." As I reflected on this also, I guess I faced a pretty uncomfortable question. Would I still be out there sharing the gospel if I was facing the sort of opposition that Paul faced, or that hundreds of thousands of Christians are facing today? Would I be persevering with my faith in Jesus and telling other people about it? It's easy for me to say yes from the comfort I enjoy here. But if I'm honest, I don't really know what I would do in a situation like that. It's hard to know without actually being the situation. I hope so, and I pray to God so through his Spirit. We're going to come now to a time of communion. It's a time to remember Jesus died because of persecution. Jesus willingly suffered an agonizing death. We come to remember Jesus and his death for us. Let me read you some short verses of scripture before we share this time of communion together. From the book of Hebrews. Therefore, chapter 12 it is, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. And let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith." I'm going to have to think about this a bit more, but it says, "For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart." So as we come to communion, let's consider him. Let's remember Jesus as he told us to. As you take the bread and as you eat it, remember that Jesus' body was given for you on the cross. And as you take the cup, remember that his blood was shed for you. So I invite you to come now to any of the tables at the corners. Take the bread and the cup. And go back to your seat. When you're ready, just eat the bread and remember Jesus. But hold the cup until everyone is back in their seats, and then we'll drink together.